Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
A mysterious illness, no clues as to where it came from. Everything and everybody becomes suspect.
People were looking at maybe the pigeons were the source. Maybe the lady who feeds the pigeons out on the sidewalk was the source.
I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. When huge crowds come together for big events, public health officials are on high alert. They have to keep an eye on everything, including that pigeon lady. She could be Typhoid Mary, right? It's their job to anticipate potential problems like food contamination or outbreaks of illnesses. That was certainly the case during the Democratic National Convention that just wrapped up here in Philadelphia. I talked, for example, to a scientist whose lab had tested 400 pounds of food samples bound for the DNC. Security was tight everywhere, and all the city's hospitals had crisis plans in place. All of this, and of course seeing the delegates flood the streets with their badges and red, white, and blue pins, got us thinking about another conference in our fair city. That one happened 40 years ago. In late July of 1976, 2,000 people came to town for a national convention of the American Legion. And that gathering became forever tied to one of the greatest medical mysteries of our time. A strange illness gripped hundreds of attendees. More than 30 died. This illness would come to be known as Legionnaire's disease. It can result in a sometimes deadly form of pneumonia. But figuring all that out required some serious shoe leather detective work. Let's listen back to a piece that we first aired earlier this year. It's from our reporter Alana Gordon. She was able to connect with some of the main characters in this 40-year-old story, and she brought us this time capsule.
The date was July 21st, 1976.
Well, that was the yearly convention of the Department of Pennsylvania.
That was when Jasper Stauffer, an airplane mechanic during World War II, arrived in Philadelphia for the statewide American Legion convention.
And then there was a lot of wives and families there at the same time.
Stauffer, who's 90 now, recalls driving in from South Central Pennsylvania with his wife, his longtime friend and colleague Charlie Chamberlain, and Chamberlain's wife, Henrietta.
Well, we were having a good time down here.
Oh, you talk over everything that you have done all year and everything that you're going to do the next year.
That is fellow Legionnaire Eugene Eichelberger, who's now 94 and remembers meeting up with his friends there. The American Legion is a support organization for wartime vets. The annual statewide convention took place just a couple weeks after the nation's bicentennial celebration. It was really hot that summer. The convention spanned 4 days. It centered around a hotel near City Hall that had large conference spaces and air-conditioned rooms. Most of the delegates stayed there.
Yes, it was a fairly nice hotel.
The convention involved a mix of committee updates, campaigning by people running for office, and socializing. Dr. Robert Sherrar remembers passing by Legion members on his walk to work. At the time, he was Philadelphia's director of infectious diseases.
But they were just elderly men, for the most part, on the older side. They seemed jovial, happy talking to one another.
And they stood out with their signature army-like hats. On the final day, the convention wrapped up with a big parade.
When the Saints Go Marching In, that was a real popular song.
Everybody danced to the as they marched down the street.
Henrietta's husband carried a banner at the front.
It was wonderful. We had a wonderful time.
But that quickly changed on the drive back home the very same day. Henrietta's husband, Charlie Chamberlain, was usually a really energetic guy. Not during those next few hours.
Whenever we got on the turnpike at Brandywine, he went to sleep. He came home and went to bed that night and never got out of bed.
Again, Henrietta.
I was trying to get him better, but every day he got worse. Every day.
His body ached. His temperature kept going up. 104 degrees, 106 degrees. She brought him to the hospital.
After taking him in on Wednesday, Thursday, they put him under ice, an ice blanket, and then Friday he was dead.
From a flu of unknown cause, doctors said.
It was a total shock for everybody.
Henrietta calls it the worst moment of her life. Her husband had died 6 days after the convention, at the age of 48. They were baffled. Stauffer recalls it was during Chamberlain's funeral that he realized his friend's death was part of something bigger.
Well, one of the other members of the headquarters staff was there, and he said that the headquarters was getting all kinds of calls from people that has got sick and passed away.
Within a week of the convention, Legion headquarters had started getting calls from around the state about members who'd fallen ill. By that following Monday, 9 days after Chamberlain fell asleep in Stauffer's car, news of this mysterious respiratory illness had spread across Pennsylvania. Dr. Sherrar was back at the health department in Philadelphia.
All of a sudden, I had four lines coming to my office. All four lines were lit up at the same time. Someone said there's some sort of an outbreak going on.
The death toll logged by the state kept growing. Four deaths, 11 deaths. They called in federal investigators from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. The man charged with overseeing that investigation was David Fraser. He's originally from Philly. He was 32 at the time, and he was director of the CDC's Special Pathogens Unit.
I spent a very intense plane ride trying to figure out how would I systematically begin to approach what looked to be a very complicated problem.
Within 48 hours of his arrival, the death toll was nearing 20, with dozens more sick. Many feared this could be the start of a swine flu outbreak, or worse, a flu pandemic like the one that had killed 50 million people in 1918. One quick aside, this would in no way reach that magnitude, but people had been primed for the next big outbreak. It triggered a massive response.
Well, this was the biggest investigation CDC undertook at the time.
Scientists working for the state of Pennsylvania and the federal government are still...
As many as 100 state and federal workers were called in. About 50 police detectives took part.
We needed to define the illness, because this was potentially a new disease.
Was it a bacteria? A virus? Some sort of toxin? It was all hands on deck.
Which means we had to send physician epidemiologists out to take histories from and examine a large number of people.
State laboratories worked all night.
There were a lot of unknowns, but news reporters quickly dubbed it Legionnaire's disease.
Everybody in the state of Pennsylvania knew about it. We had worldwide recognition. We had phone calls from as far away as Australia asking us questions about it.
What did they do at the American Legion Convention?
And to find answers, Fraser and his investigative squad had to cast a wide net. There was no central list of who had even attended the convention. So they distributed questionnaires to the hundreds of Legion posts throughout the state. Police delivered the forms by car.
How easy is it to get a questionnaire completed out? How do you get 10,000 questionnaires distributed throughout the state of Pennsylvania? It takes a lot of cooperation.
And they called us into the Chambersburg headquarters, and we went over those questionnaires.
The team telephoned random samples of people who weren't even at the convention. They monitored family members of those who'd gotten sick. Early on, it became clear this was not the major flu pandemic some had feared. The disease seemed mostly confined to the Legionnaires' convention. But still, Fraser says the public pressure mounted to figure this out.
This was a time when certainly infectious diseases were thought to have been largely worked out and controlled, some people thought. It challenged assumptions.
And it increased the fear. Was it something people ate or drank? Investigators were stumped. But they did have one general suspect in mind.
It was called the Grand Old Lady of Broad Street. I mean, that's what I've always heard it referred to. And she was the Grand Old Lady of Broad Street.
Sherrar, again with Philadelphia's health department, is referring to the Bellevue Stratford, the hotel where many of the delegates stayed and where many of the Legionnaires' meetings took place. This wasn't just any hotel.
It's a grand old hotel.
The Bellevue, with its classy French Renaissance design, was the hotel in Philadelphia.
The artwork inside the building, you know, the columns and things, they don't do it like that anymore.
It had 19 floors and ballrooms that could accommodate thousands. It was the place where visiting royalty would stay, where local politicians were known to congregate. So could this iconic pillar of the city be the killer? Investigators flagged it in their reports, and it didn't take long for this to become a media frenzy. People canceled reservations, the place emptied out. But for Fraser, there was only one way to get to the bottom of this. After spending the first week of the investigation in the state capital of Harrisburg, he and several others joined the Philadelphia crew on the ground. And guess where they stayed?
There were rooms available, and we got a good price.
Fraser brought his team to the Bellevue. He really wanted to solve this mystery. So much so, he half-jokingly even had this thought.
There was part of me that was hoping that somebody got sick. This might give an important clue.
No, none of his staff got sick. They were pretty confident the disease didn't pose an ongoing threat. But they did really want to understand the place. Was the culprit lurking in a certain room? Fraser had his own idea. He recalls this going back through the now restored hotel nearly 40 years later.
And I thought perhaps an elevator would permit an agent to waft into the air as the elevator went up and down. But we found no evidence.
Other theories and conspiracies filled the void. Maybe the illness came from pigeons, or better yet, the lady who fed the pigeons. Some, like Jasper Stauffer, even thought they'd been attacked.
My theory is that the ones that got sick got it at the parade. That there was people there that sprayed stuff at them.
Environmental specialists combed the hotel, crawling through heating and cooling vents, collecting samples. Fraser and his team worked around the clock, reviewing the evidence, going through what's called line lists of the cases, looking for patterns. But how diseases choose their victims can be tricky. Legionnaires were mostly older men who smoked. It was thought that made some of them more susceptible to getting sick. In the end, Fraser left the hotel with really only two leads.
Yeah, we're coming up to the lobby here. It's a dominated by a clock.
The more time people spent in the lobby of the hotel, the more at risk they were for contracting the disease. And the more time spent just outside the hotel, on the sidewalk, the greater the risk. Some people who had nothing to do with the convention had gotten sick. So in late August, almost a month after the convention, Fraser returned to Atlanta, the puzzle still incomplete in what had caused this mysterious airborne disease that in the final count had resulted in 34 deaths and sickened about 200 more. Back in the CDC labs, scientists continued reviewing samples and running more tests. Weeks went by. Still, no answers. It was starting to be seen as a total failure in the public's eye.
It was a very high pressure, very frustrating.
By November, Congress called Fraser and other top officials in for a hearing.
We expected to be raked over the coals for failing to solve an outbreak, and we were raked over the coals. It was a very unpleasant couple of hours.
They faced criticism for how long it took for everyone to respond when calls had come in about an illness early on. Some pointed to a lack of coordination. Did investigators even collect the right specimens? And then there was the Bellevue Stratford, Philadelphia's Grand Hotel. It had already been in financial trouble, but the outbreak was the final fatal straw. It closed that same month. Fraser, meanwhile, worried about morale. Some of the CDC scientists had spent years trying to solve other outbreaks with no success. He feared that fatigue would roll over and that any momentum would be lost.
Which I was afraid was going to set in with Legionnaire's disease, too.
Did you think maybe it would take years?
Yes. I hope it would only take years.
But then around Christmas, with few leads and patients running out, Fraser's team finally caught a break. The story goes that a scientist in one of the labs who'd been working on this, Joseph McDade, was out at a holiday party.
He went to a Christmas party, he told me, and was berated by somebody who said, CDC has screwed up. Yeah, they should have solved this. Well, this is terrible. That you work at CDC, don't you? And all that. And that got him a little upset.
I wasn't able to contact McDade, but going back through the old newspaper stories, it was reported that he was haunted by this. So he went back to the lab. He reviewed his materials, and this time focused on looking for something he didn't recognize, something unusual. He described the process like searching for a missing contact lens on a basketball court, with your eyes 4 inches away from the floor.
Joe's brilliance, among other things, is that he was willing to take a second look at that and think about it in a different way.
McDade zeroed in on a detail he had brushed off that he thought was a lab error. He repeated the tests. Part of this involved inoculating guinea pigs with material from Legionnaires' victims to try and recreate the illness and identify what was causing it. But this time, McDade did notice something new. I'm simplifying, but once he figured out the right way to stain the sample, he saw a tiny cluster of rod-shaped objects. It was a bacteria, one that he and others had never seen before. 5.5 months after the convention, after Charlie Chamberlain's death, McDade had identified the killer. Fraser was ecstatic.
I was so excited. This was such a spectacular, it was a great weight off my shoulders and a great discovery, a very, very special discovery.
Shirar, our epidemiologist back in Philadelphia, celebrated from afar.
It was a big event.
They called the new bacteria Legionella pneumophila. Translation?
So it's an organism that loves the lung of the Legionnaires that causes Legionnaires' disease.
Fraser and others went from being humiliated to congratulated. Scientists would go on to identify the bacteria in the majority of samples from victims, further confirming the discovery. And they'd confirm effective antibiotics to treat it. But wait a minute. Where had the bacteria come from? Fraser retraces his steps around the outside of the Bellevue nearly 40 years after the outbreak, which, by the way, has since reopened.
And what we think in reconstructing what happened, what we think was going on...
He looks up and points to the cooling towers on the top of the building's mansard roof.
We can't see from this ground level of perch. There are cooling towers.
Fraser explains that Legionella bacteria occurs naturally in the environment, but it really likes to grow in warm water. And one ideal environment is the warm water basins and cooling systems. And when those cooling systems convert warm water into cold air, it produces a mist as a byproduct.
And that mist can come across the edge of the roof and layer down the side of a building. It's one of the curious things about airflow in cities.
Fraser says that contaminated mist in the Bellevue's cooling tower would have dropped down the side of the hotel, exposing people on the sidewalk. It also would have been sucked into a vent near the ground that leads right into the lobby, exposing people there.
See, here are some of these utility vents here. And so that would be air intake for the ventilation system of the...
Future Legionnaires' disease outbreaks would also be directly linked to cooling systems, which means buildings can prevent the problem by disinfecting those systems. Scientists also realized the bacteria was responsible for previous unsolved outbreaks. In the public health community, the story of Legionnaires' disease has turned into a sort of poster child for the power of epidemiology. I'm talking about that shoe leather detective work involved in mapping out patterns and understanding how diseases move and strike. These would be critical tools for Shirar and others just a few years later, in the early 80s, when a mysterious disease called AIDS would explode into the American consciousness. Philadelphia would be an epicenter in the fight, and Dr. Shirar would play a key role. But listening to him and Fraser talk about Legionnaires' disease, I'm struck by just how tricky and complicated these investigations are. Mother Nature can throw all sorts of curveballs. Diseases are often a step ahead. And figuring it all out, managing the science and the politics, can be messy. Going back to the Legionnaires example, technically, scientists weren't actually able to identify the original bacteria in the hotel's cooling system, because by the time they'd figured out how to test for it in the environment, the hotel's cooling system had already been cleaned out. Again, Fraser.
It was a year late, and nothing grew.
Do you feel a little incomplete that you never, like, quite got the confirmation of the source?
Sure.
Fraser doesn't lose sleep over this. He points to all the evidence. But?
It would be nice to know, with more certainty, the source in the Philadelphia outbreak.
Like, how nice?
Be nice. I'd have paid extra for that, yeah.
The discovery of Legionnaires' disease also didn't lead to its demise. Scientists have learned it's not just a cooling system problem, and there are thousands of cases annually. Which means its name and recurrence is a constant reminder to those with ties to 1976. Jasper Stauffer, who's 90 and still active in the Legion, says he's moved on since then, but he hasn't forgotten.
Because there was a lot of friends got sick and passed away. And Legion Conventions has never been the same.
How do you feel about the name of the disease, Legionnaires' disease?
Well, I had no real feelings about it because it happened to Legionnaires, so leave it at that name.
The name itself was controversial at first, but at least for some of these war veterans, they've come to embrace it. Almost like a badge of honor. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott. And since we first aired this piece a few months ago, our reporter Alana Gordon was actually able to connect with Joseph McDade. He's the researcher who made all the difference in this mystery. Alana, you finally got him on the phone. You were really excited about this, I remember.
Yeah, I was excited about this. I felt like it was this final piece to a puzzle about just understanding the turn and the science. In this story of, wait, suddenly this guy found it. And it was fascinating to talk to Joseph McDade, a self-described backbencher lab scientist at the CDC. So he said it was pretty much shielded from a lot of the drama happening on the outside. But he described himself as a pretty compulsive guy. And so that Christmas, when no one had answers, he went back to his lab, went through slides, reran some tests. And when all else had failed, he noticed something unusual.
As we broke the code and found out that they were falling into this particular pattern, I can still remember the hair raising up on the back of my neck.
More testing, more confirmation needed to come after that, but this was a big, obviously, turning point. He'd identified a bacteria. He didn't work in a bacteria lab. He wasn't looking for bacteria. And for McDade, though, being that scientist in the lab, it really did change his approach as a scientist. And the decades that followed, and he went on to do a lot of things.
You know, I am still learning lessons from this.
Alana, what did he tell you? What were some of the specific lessons?
You know, one of the key things, first and foremost, is just question things. Don't assume the obvious. No, it can't possibly be a bacteria. There's no way it was a bacteria. So really start at base level, open mind when you're searching for answers for something that you don't know. The other thing that he really learned was to think about things outside of just that the procedures that happen in a lab. It really changed his framework to think about how does what I'm looking for right now, how can this be sharpened and framed in the broader scheme of trends, of epidemiology, of the broader things at play.
Data becomes information, information becomes knowledge, and hopefully someday knowledge collectively becomes wisdom.
Alana, despite that wisdom that has been gained over four decades, Legionnaires' disease still happens all the time. We hear about it on the news. There are outbreaks.
True story. It's still out there. Many argue that the cases are actually on the rise. But when you think about what Joseph McNade just said, that collectively this knowledge becomes wisdom, that's exactly what's been happening with Legionnaires' disease. Over the years, scientists have been learning more and more about it and the different ways and the different places that it's present, the ways that it's spread. And so that, in fact, has now prompted even newer industry standards to prevent it in buildings.
So the key to Legionella prevention is that you know whether it's there or not.
So that's Janet Stout. She heads the Special Pathogens Lab in Pittsburgh. And she was actually part of this committee that last year developed the new industry standards for preventing Legionnaires' disease in buildings.
And Alana, we've put more information on that and your interview with Joseph McDade on our website. You can find that at whyy.org/thepulse. Thank you so much, Alana.
Thanks, Megan.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Now we're going to move on from that convention 40 years ago to the one that just wrapped up, the Democratic National Convention. It was a string of politically charged and also brutally hot days. I did some reporting on the convention, and I was walking around downtown in Center City, Philadelphia, just to soak up some of the DNC excitement. But it was so hot and I was sweating so much, I ended up ducking into an exhibit called Political Fest to soak up some of the air conditioning. Political Fest, it was, you know, a heavy on the fun, light on the education kind of collection of curiosities. There were a lot of photo opportunities. You could get your picture taken stepping off an Air Force One replica, or you could take your picture talking on the phone in a mock Oval Office. People were doing that and posting stuff on social media. And if your phone ran out of battery from all of that, then you could recharge it there, with the caveat that you had to make your own energy by pedaling a bike. Of course, I had to try this. My phone was charged 67% when I plugged it into the little rig attached to the bike. And then I started pedaling. Let's see how long it will take me to get to 68%. I pedaled for a minute, then I checked it again. 67%. Holy moly. I tried for another minute. All right. I'm giving up. So, never got to 68%. Making your own energy obviously isn't for everybody, but while I was on the bike, I was thinking about, you know, how much every day I read about climate change, how much people talk about it. And for all that, it doesn't seem like this topic came up very much so far in this election cycle. Joining me now to talk more about that is our environmental reporter, Irina Zhorov. Hi, Irina.
Hi, Maiken.
Irina, I talked to some people who covered the Republican convention. They said the environment was not a major issue during those days. You covered the Democratic National Convention here in Philadelphia. You spoke to delegates. What did they say about the environment?
So I spoke to delegates both for Bernie Sanders and for Hillary Clinton, and they said the environment is an important issue for them. And if you remember from the primary season, the environment did come up. It just wasn't the most important thing for any of the candidates, really. But Bernie Sanders, for example, he said climate change was the biggest threat to our national security. Hillary Clinton spoke about climate change as well, how important it is. And walking around, I spoke to one delegate from Minnesota, a gentleman in his 70s. He's an alternate, actually. His name is Jim Cohen. He said for him, the environment is one of two or three of the most important issues. And so he said that he supports what the Democratic Party is talking about regarding the environment.
I'm satisfied that no matter what the specific words may be, the party gestalt, the overall commitment of this party is to bring about a very healthy environment in every sense of the word. And that's what the millennials want. And that's what we owe to the next generations.
So this guy has more environmental cred than most. He's worked for several environmental organizations, national ones. And yet, even as we were talking, we only spoke for a couple of minutes, he seemed really eager to pivot to other issues. And I think that reflects kind of how a lot of people are thinking about it. Even people who are concerned about the environment, there's just much bigger issues kind of at the forefront for them.
I met one gentleman at this political fest that I mentioned earlier. His name was Tobias DeVore, and he was very passionate about the environment. He had helped organize a big march in Philadelphia just days prior for green energy. And basically, he said he wants sustainable energy and he wants it now.
I would love to see it happen. We can have a fast and quick transition. By 10 years, 15, 20 years, we could be at 100% renewable power, and that's what I would love to see.
He was also really passionate about fracking, and he said basically Hillary is not moving fast enough on all of those issues for him. What is her platform?
So Hillary, she recognizes climate change as an urgent threat. She lays out a plan to invest in renewables, to regulate fossil fuel production, cut energy waste, and promote conservation. The party platform is pretty similar. I called up Bill McKibben. He's an environmentalist. He actually helped draft the party platform. He was one of the people appointed by the Bernie Sanders camp. And he said he didn't get everything he wanted. For example, a total ban on fracking was one of the things. But he said that it makes great strides.
The platform does have a lot of good language in it and represents a quantum advance from what it was 4 years ago. Then it was in favor of an all-of-the-above energy policy. Now it explicitly prioritizes sun and wind over natural gas.
Now, what is Trump's stance on all of this, and what's the Republican Party's platform?
Yeah, so Trump doesn't actually have a position on environmental or energy issues, at least not kind of officially on his website or as part of his platform. But he has talked about it in speeches and in interviews, you know, throughout the primary season. So he said he wants to bring back coal production. He supports oil and gas extraction. He doesn't believe in climate change. He's actually called it a Chinese hoax in the past. He also said he wants to undo regulations put in place by the Obama administration, and he wants to defund the Environmental Protection Agency. The party platform, it supports the development of all sorts of energy, quote, that are marketable in a free economy without subsidies. And it mentions by name coal, oil, natural gas, nuclear power, and hydropower. And they also have an interest in limiting the powers of the EPA.
Do you think now that the candidates have been chosen, the race is about to start for real, will the environment come up more?
So the Pew Research Center, they looked at this issue, right? What are the things that are very important to voters? The number one issue is the economy. So the environment falls in place number 12. It's wedged between trade policy and abortion down there. But it is the issue where the voters have the biggest priority discrepancy, right? So I mentioned the economy. All voters pretty much think that the economy is very important, even though they may have different ideas about what to do with it. But for example, only 32% of Trump voters think that the environment is very important. And for Hillary supporters, that number is 69% that think it's very important. So I think as we move into a general election, Clinton will bring it up more because it's something that she will use to really set herself apart from Trump.
Thank you so much, Irina.
Thanks, Maiken.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
This is The Pulse with stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott, and our next story is about patient experiences. When I look at pictures of myself after the birth of my daughter 5 years ago, I look miserable. even though this was a really happy moment in my life. But I had had a C-section and I was taken to a small room afterwards, and I had to share that room with another new mom. It was really hot in there, and I remember sweat just pouring off my forehead. And the other mom had lots of visitors. They talked a lot, they were laughing, her baby was crying, and I was just so exhausted, and I also felt exposed in my hospital gown. All I wanted to do was to go away to a quiet, spa-like room with a really comfortable bed and a lot more privacy. If you're a celebrity or a high-powered executive, there's a good chance you will have this kind of service while getting medical treatment. Maybe you could have lunch catered to you as you wait for your appointment. VIP medical care is in demand, and organizations are responding by creating special spaces. But listen to this. When it comes to the actual medical care itself, there can be downsides to special treatment. Pulse contributor and University of Maryland School of Medicine internist Netta Freja reports.
The dress code for today is strict. No skirts, dresses, or open-toed shoes. And there will be hard hats. I'm walking through a construction zone inside the Johns Hopkins Outpatient Center in Baltimore. The floor is covered in brown paper and sawdust. Electrical wires hang from the ceiling. The path ahead is paved with ladders and giant cans of paint.
As we move down the hallway, now we're in what will be the new executive lounge.
Ashley Barrett is the director of the Johns Hopkins Executive and Preventive Health Program. She's walking me through a construction site that, in a few months, will be a modern, spacious patient care facility with floor-to-ceiling windows, a gym, and showers with marble accents. Think five-star hotel or spa.
We've moved it to the corner of the building so patients can have a view of the Baltimore skyline and also the harbor. We thought this would be a more appealing space for them.
By them, Ashley means their patients. Executives, mostly, but sometimes politicians, maybe even celebrities. Some have a special benefit through their insurance plan that pays for this medical care, which can run up to several thousand dollars a visit. But many people pay out of pocket.
And now we're standing in the VIP suite. So this is for very high profile or recognizable patients who need a more private area. This suite has its own exam room, its own waiting room, and its own restroom.
Whether a high-profile patient goes to a special private office or a regular hospital, there's the issue of the medical care itself, the evaluation and making decisions about treatment. Here is where VIP syndrome may happen, where VIP stands for very important patient.
Basically a catch-all phrase for when a person who is rich or influential is treated differently because of the special status.
Liz Kowalsik is a medical reporter at the Boston Globe. She spent months investigating this phenomenon at one Boston hospital. She says that in VIP syndrome, the power differential between doctor and patient can shift. Care providers may defer more to the patient's requests, even if these requests aren't good for them.
And that can involve giving the person more care than you would normally give another patient, such as more tests, or it can involve giving them less care, such as skipping an embarrassing exam, like a prostate exam.
The medical literature is full of examples of VIP care gone wrong, when special treatment can lead to worse outcomes. Liz told me about the case she researched. It involved a prince from another country.
This patient had a multi-drug resistant infection, so a serious infection that wasn't treatable by normal antibiotics. And policy calls for anybody who goes into that room to wear a gown and gloves to protect themselves from infection and also to protect other patients. This patient was offended by that. He felt it was insulting and requested people not wear that protective gear, and so they didn't. So in this situation, caregivers were endangering themselves as well as other patients.
Then there was the catheter issue.
Caregivers suspected that his catheter might have been contaminated, causing an infection. And normal policy would be to change that. But he didn't want it changed, and so they didn't change it. The special treatment was really endangering the patient himself.
There were other concerns, too, about the thousands of dollars in cash gifts the patient gave staff members and about how many painkillers the patient was on. The overprescription of narcotics for pain comes up a lot in VIP syndrome.
There's a mantra, we treat all patients the same, and that's sort of the public statement. You know, I think it's important for institutions to examine if that's really true in a clear-eyed way.
I get that clear-eyed view. I'm an internist, and I'll be honest, it can be a little overwhelming if someone powerful is sitting in the exam room with you. I'd love to say that it makes no difference at all, ever, but at first you may second-guess yourself or even let the patient dictate some of their own care. Sarah Clever, an internist at Johns Hopkins who recently wrote about caring for influential patients, offered me this advice.
Hopefully towards the beginning of the meeting, I say, you know, I know that you have this status. And I say, I have a certain algorithm that I follow in how I care for patients. And I know that when I do that, I provide my best care.
Sarah draws from her work as a physician, but she's also had a personal experience with VIP syndrome. About 6 years ago, she was pregnant with twins and on vacation in Mexico when her heart started racing. She couldn't breathe. She broke out into a sweat. She knew it was an emergency. She had to be airlifted back to Baltimore, to her own hospital's cardiac ICU, where she became the VIP.
What I saw were errors of over-treatment and, interestingly, under-asking. I had a very fast heart rhythm, which can be provoked by stimulants, and no one asked me if I had used any drugs. Cocaine, alcohol, no one even asked me if I drank coffee. It made me wonder, what else are they not doing because I'm a physician?
When it comes to patient care, she recommends asking colleagues for advice when it feels like there's pressure to do things differently. There's also another resource for VIP care. Here again is Liz Kowalczyk, the Boston Globe reporter who's written about this topic.
The Cleveland Clinic, which, you know, deals with a lot of high-profile patients, it became enough of an issue there that they wrote a guide, sort of 9 principles for dealing with VIP patients.
These include how to communicate with the media, protecting patient privacy, and how to accept or decline cash gifts. Another principle says to resist chairperson syndrome.
VIP patients, or a lot of times their families, really, or their entourage, will sort of demand the chair of the department. But again, this is an example where being treated in a special way is actually to the VIP's detriment.
Because sometimes the doctor you want may not be the boss, but the one really involved in hands-on clinical work day after day. According to the Cleveland Clinic, the number one principle of caring for VIPs is don't bend the rules. Stick with tried and true practices that are based in evidence and that generally work pretty well. VIPs are often relieved when their doctor says, I am going to treat you the way I would any other patient. After all, every patient should be treated as very important. For The Pulse, I'm Netta Freja.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Patients who spend a lot of time in hospitals often try to make the best of their stay. Maybe they bring in their own blankets or food they like, a book or a movie, whatever it takes to make their stay just a little bit more comfortable. In this week's edition of our series, Patient Files, we meet a family that takes this idea to a whole other level. They've been throwing chemo parties at the University of Pennsylvania's Cancer Center every time their loved one has to go in for treatment.
Today is mom's 50th chemo session, so we're throwing her a 50th party, and it's a golden theme, because 50 is the golden year, so even though we're not 50 years, we're 50 chemo infusions, so we went with this black tie formal affair with gold cupcakes and gold streamers. It's a celebration, for sure.
Cheers.
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 Team Debbie.
My name is Debbie Hammes. 4 years ago, I was diagnosed with lung cancer. Of course, it was a big shock to me. Originally, I was going to see doctors for allergy reasons, and I had been losing weight drastically, And I knew at that time, I knew something else was wrong. It wasn't until I took a chest x-ray and found that the tumor was almost the size of my fist. And since the cancer is outside, it wasn't inside my lung, it turned out to be that it was inoperable. So the only choices that I had at that time was to have radiation, and then they did chemo. I was devastated, and it was a shock. And you never think that something like that's going to happen to you until it actually does.
My name is Kelly McAllister. I am the daughter of Debbie Hemmes. When my mom was diagnosed with cancer, probably a little bit of denial at first. Kind of how she says, you know, you don't think that something can happen to you. Though it wasn't me who was diagnosed with cancer, I didn't think my mom or somebody in my family would ever be diagnosed with cancer. So I think that it was a little bit of denial, a little bit of shock. Turned into acceptance, and which started the development of my idea for chemo parties.
All right, we're going to sing Happy 50th chemo.
Okay. Ready?
Happy chemo to you.
Set.
Ready?
Go.
Happy chemo to you.
It just kind of came to me, you know, let's throw a party for her. You know, every time that she has chemo, let's throw a party. That's exactly what we did. And so I planned a different themed party every time she had chemo. And now she has maintenance chemo. We kind of stick to, you know, what holiday we're around. So, you know, and just keep following through with the seasons and the holidays.
Having a chemo party is just a way of celebrating. And not moping about of what the disease itself. You know, the party basically is a celebration to keep on going.
Cupcakes to everybody, too.
Right now, I'm just basically in the maintenance phase. I go every month for, or every other month for my scans just to make sure everything's clear. Basically, they're seeing no signs of active cancer cells moving around right now. So basically, it's just a matter of just taking the chemo once a month. And that's basically what I'll be doing for the rest of my life.
Will you come stand with me and cheers with me? Come on. Ching, ching.
Okay. I want to spread this so that other people can do this and other people can see what a positive attitude does for health. I truly, truly believe in the power of positive attitude and the power of family and the power of support. My mother is living proof.
60 cupcakes.
Because what's their name? You know, one.
Debbie Hemmes and her daughter Kelly McAllister talking about chemo parties. Avery Brookins produced this piece. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, Todd Bookman, and Irina Zhorov. Joel Wolfram is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Paige Flager, the associate producer. Joel Patterson, our managing editor. And Megan Pinto, our executive producer. Next week on The Pulse.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Those who get to travel to space often describe their experience as life-altering.
But the most memorable part of that first day in space was when I got to look out the window for the first time.
How looking at Earth from far away inspires awe.
To fly over the Great Barrier Reef, to be outside on a spacewalk and fly through an aurora. These are things that, you know, just are deeply etched in my mind.
Don't miss that episode of The Pulse. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.